And welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak for Marty Moscoane.
Then close your eyes and tap your heels together 3 times. And think to yourself, there's no place like home. There's no place like home.
There's no place like home. There's no place like home.
Well, for so many of us, there really is no place like home. Like Dorothy, we can find ourselves longing for familiar places and faces. In fact, so much so that we can become homesick. In days gone by, doctors called it nostalgia, and it was considered to be a potentially fatal illness. In fact, it was deemed to be the cause of death for dozens of Civil War soldiers and left many others gravely ill. So today, many of us are reluctant to admit to homesickness. After all, we're mobile and we're connected, and who needs to click their heels when they can simply click the mouse, or so we might think now that we have Skype and smartphones and the like. Well, this hour, we are looking at homesickness through the lens of history and psychology, and we've got some help for those who struggle with it today. Not you, of course, but people you know. Our guests are Dr. Susan Matt, author of Homesickness and American History. She is Presidential Distinguished Professor of History at Weber State University in Ogden, Utah. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you. And also with us is Dr. Christopher Thurber, who is a board-certified clinical psychologist, educator, author, dad, and expert on homesickness. He co-authored the critically acclaimed Summer Camp Handbook, and he knows a thing or two about camp. In fact, he is joining us from Camp Belknap, where you are in your 31st or 32nd season there, Chris, as a waterfront director. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And is this year 31 or 32?
32.
Wow. Are you homesick?
No, not anymore.
How about the kids there? Have you seen any homesick kids thus far?
Sure, yeah. Every summer, despite much of our effort to prevent homesickness, and in my research I have discovered that it's largely preventable, at least when we're talking about a 2 or 4 or 7 week stay at summer camp. But as I'm sure Susan will tell you as well, this is a normative feeling when people are away from home. So everybody experiences some feelings of homesickness when they're away. And the good news is that it's just a minority of children who feel it so intensely that it interferes with their having a good time at camp.
Well, let's start off by defining our terms, Chris. What exactly is homesickness from a medical or psychological perspective?
Well, the way my co-author, Edward Walton, and I defined it, it's preoccupying thoughts of home and attachment objects. And really, if we're looking at homesickness as a normative feeling, from a clinical psychological standpoint, what we want to do is make a distinction between those normative feelings and feelings that are interfering with functioning. So when it starts to be hard for kids to eat or sleep or play games, or if we're talking about adults, if it starts to be hard for them to get up out of bed in the morning and go to work or do the things that they're supposed to be doing, going to school, for example, or as Susan talks about in her book, fighting on the battlefield, then we're talking about something that has some clinical import. And again, preoccupying thoughts of home and attachment objects, the emotions that go along with homesickness usually are some feelings of anxiety, some feelings of sadness or depression, maybe some loneliness and social withdrawal.
Okay. And Susan, why do we get homesick to begin with?
Well, in America, it's very common because we're such a mobile population, and we teach our children from a young age to leave home, and we expect to leave home ourselves. We never talk about the hidden costs of that mobility, however. The emotion has largely become hidden for adults. It's something we still obviously deal with when we talk about kids at summer camp or kids going to college, but we're expecting that once they are 18 or 19, the emotion will be gone, and in reality, it lingers far into adulthood. And I think it would be easier to deal with if it were more publicly discussed.
And Susan, you talked about in your book how it made soldiers in the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, that they were literally ill, and doctors believed that the source of that ultimately was homesickness.
That's right. During the Civil War, 5,500 Union soldiers are diagnosed with acute cases of homesickness, which they call nostalgia, and 74 Union soldiers die of it, and Confederate soldiers experienced it as well. it was a commonly known malady, there were all sorts of associated symptoms, from throbbing of the arteries to incontinence to heart problems, and people were believed that they, it was believed you could waste away and die from it. It was such a problem that even the Union Army sometimes banned the playing of the song Home Sweet Home because they thought it would make soldiers melancholic and waste away.
So, Chris, how do we explain that in today's terms? You talked about symptoms like anxiety, depression, things like that. And we're talking about some soldiers that doctors in that time, you know, saw certain symptoms, palpitations, those kinds of things, and diagnosed it as homesickness. So how can we sort of reconcile the diagnosis from the 1800s with what we see today?
Well, I think it's probably the same thing, and you can go even further back in history and find references in the Old Testament. You know, when the Jewish people are in exile in Egypt, or in Homer's Odyssey, I read the opening scene of the Odyssey where Athena is arguing with her father Zeus, and he asks her, why should we bring Odysseus home? And basically, my reading of her reply is, because he misses it, because he's homesick. And so I think that since there have been people, they have been attached to the other people around them and been attached to the places that are familiar to them. So my answer to your question is, we are wired to connect from birth, and we connect with other people, and usually we begin with our primary caregivers. That could be our mom or dad, and it just grows from there. And then we become very attached to the places that are familiar to us. And this has some very adaptive functions, because when we detect that things are different, we pay attention to them in a way that helps us survive. But when we're removed or dislocated from the places and people with whom we're familiar, it hurts. And the longer we're away and the more difficult the circumstances of our departure, the more aversive the novel environment, the more challenging it is for us. And so you can start to see physical symptoms of homesickness, like Susan was describing. But I think the phenomenon of homesickness hasn't changed. I think it's the same. People are feeling the same things they have always felt.
Susan, you talked about how it may be more obvious in children, but that adults also deal with homesickness. Is it, are children more susceptible to homesickness than adults, or no?
I think children are experiencing leave-taking for the first time, which may make it more raw experience. I also think they're probably less guarded in some of their responses and expressions of the emotion, whereas by the time you're an adult in 20th and 21st century America, you've learned that people are going to think you're a big baby if you talk about your longing for home. They're going to think you're unambitious, maladjusted, immature. So now we sort of know the emotional code of modern America, where you repress the emotion. Children haven't learned that yet.
Chris, have you seen that? Do you think there's a stigma, so to speak, associated with homesickness, particularly for, you know, those who are past childhood?
I think so. I think Susan's right. I think one other thing that happens when you go from a child to an adolescent to an adult is you acquire more sophisticated coping strategies. So while it may not be particularly permissible for a businessman or a businesswoman on an international trip to say to his or her friend or partner or spouse, I feel really homesick. So yes, there is a stigma associated with it. There's a countervailing force, which is that adult has had more experience away from home and has developed more sophisticated coping strategies. So that's the good news, is that there's a lot that you can think or do to help make things better when you feel homesick. But I think that we all operate under the false assumption that talking about it makes it worse, or camp counselors who are worried to talk to kids about homesickness, or parents who are concerned that if they bring it up prior to a separation, whether that's summer camp or boarding school, that they're somehow going to make it happen. And nothing could be further from the truth. We should destigmatize it. We should be talking about it so that we can learn how to cope with it and anticipate it as a normal feeling. It's a negative feeling, but it's a reflection of something very positive, which is the strength of our attachments to people and places.
Well, and Chris, you know a thing or two about camps and how they handle these kinds of issues. I know that there are lots of camps that are really restrictive about, you know, parents contacting their children or any sort of reminders of home in an effort to, you know, I guess sort of fend off the problem of homesickness. What do you think about that?
Well, it's interesting, and I'd love for Susan to weigh in on this as well. I think that one of the things that camps were originally designed to do when they began in this country 160 years ago is promote self-reliance. And so in the spirit of nurturing kids' burgeoning independence, I think it's very good that most overnight camps don't allow, for example, phone contact or email or Skyping between parents and kids. That immediate real-time contact tends to retard kids' social development insofar as their self-reliance and independence because they stay connected. You know, I call it the digital umbilical. So I don't think that that's helpful. To talk to your son or daughter while he or she is away at camp is a very emotional experience for parents, and it tends to exacerbate homesickness. On the other hand, when the contact is limited to letter writing, you do nurture kids' independence, and they become more self-reliant. They learn these coping skills, which are going to serve them well freshman year in college or that year abroad or the international trip or any time that you're away from your family, loved ones, or familiar places. So I think it's important that camps hold the line and don't allow kids to call home or get on email or Skype. I think that's important. Your opener was really interesting, right? The Wizard of Oz, which I see very differently now, having done research on homesickness, than I did when I watched it as a child. But you remember how indignant the Scarecrow was at the end of the movie when he asks Glinda, the Good Witch, why didn't you tell Dorothy at the beginning? I don't understand. You know, if she had the power all along, why didn't you just tell her that she needed to click her heels together three times and say there's no place like home? And if you remember, Glinda's response is she had to learn it for herself. And everyone has kind of a thoughtful moment there. And I think that that's very much the case today, as it's always been. There are some things that we need to experience and endure to prompt us to become sophisticated in the way we regulate our emotions. So I don't want anyone to feel bad, but distress is what motivates our learning coping skills. So on the one hand, we want to prevent extreme homesickness. On the other hand, wrestling with it to a moderate degree is what's going to inoculate us in a future separation.
Yeah, how do you conquer it if you don't experience it
first?
So, Susan, we have 30 seconds. I'd like, if you would, for you to quickly weigh in on that, too.
Well, I do think it's important for children to learn to be mature and independent. However, I think it's much more of a preoccupation in America than it is other places, and this concern about how connected people are or how independent they are is something you won't find in a lot of other more communally oriented cultures. So sometimes I wonder if this idea and this model of personality development isn't very culturally specific. It's not an absolute good. It's how we're training children in a capitalist society that prizes mobility and the ability to break ties.
Well, you've brought up an interesting point for us to talk about when we come back. We're talking about homesickness, why we get homesick, and what we can do about it. Much more to come when Radio Times comes back.
Greensgrow Farm supports WHYY. The Greensgrow Camden Mobile Markets are open Thursdays and Fridays in 8 Camden neighborhood locations. Full details at greensgrow.org/Camden.
This week on This American Life. Yeah! Imagine if that's how you felt about your job and that this guy was your boss.
Today I don't feel like riding any rides.
This, by the way, is a staff meeting.
I just want to play all the games.
We go behind the scenes at an amusement park and meet the guy singing this song who is possibly better suited for his job than anyone I have ever met this week.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
In the wake of last week's deadly shooting in a Colorado movie theater, we've been talking about mental health and about our nation's gun laws. Now we'll ask our panel of women commentators to weigh in from their diverse perspectives. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The Chester County Hospital supports WHYY and is committed to delivering comprehensive care in an environment where respect, compassion, and quality come first. To learn how they help make lives better every day, ChesterCountyHospital.org.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowain. We're talking about homesickness and how this is a time of year with so many children off at camp and some of the older ones heading off to college, perhaps for the first time, that homesickness can become an issue, and not just for the children, but for their parents in some cases. We're sorting through why we get homesick and what we can do about it, and we've got some help from Dr. Susan Matt, who is the author of a book called Homesickness and American History. And we also have with us Dr. Chris Thurber, who is a board-certified clinical psychologist. He also has written the critically acclaimed Summer Camp Handbook. I want to welcome both of you back and invite our listeners to join us in this conversation about homesickness. Maybe you've got some stories of your own about homesickness that you'd like to share. The number is 888-477-9499. Susan Matt, you brought up such an interesting point just before we went to the break that really sort of goes back to what Chris said about that digital umbilical, about how here in the United States, at least, that, you know, there's such a sense of connectedness between parents and children. And there are books written about, you know, college kids who are just constantly in communication with their parents to the point where it feels like they never really left home. I'd love for you to talk about that some more.
Well, you certainly see it today with the widespread addiction to cell phones, texting, that people of all generations are engaging in, and that longing to connect with parents, with distant friends, is ubiquitous. I would argue it's not particularly new. If you looked at pioneers in the West, gold miners in California, they were addicted to letter writing and would try to have as much contact as possible rather than using Instagram to upload photos. They would send each other daguerreotypes, you know, old photos through the post in an effort to share what they were experiencing. So I think that way of connecting to offset homesickness is nothing new. I think we worry about it a lot more today than our ancestors did, and I argue that that's really a sign that we've become a much more individualistic people in the 20th and the 21st century. There was not such a fear of family connectedness. There weren't fears of people being in too frequent communication in the 19th century. People celebrated that and thought of homesickness actually as a sign of love, of home, as a sign of virtue. What could be better than to love your home? So we've pathologized that emotion in the 20th century and the 21st, and I think that's where a lot of our worries about umbilical cords comes from.
Chris, what do you say?
I think Susan's spot on, and she's the history expert, and I think that her description of homesickness as a virtuous phenomenon is wonderful. I do think, as I said earlier, that it's a reflection of something very, very positive, which is the strength of our attachments to people and places. And one of the things that's wonderful about letter writing is that it's asynchronous. In other words, you have to sit there and reflect and write, and by creating a narrative, you understand your experience better. And then you put it in the mail, and you have to wait. And you don't have to wait as long as you did during the gold rush to get the reply back, but you certainly do have to wait a couple of days. And in that waiting, you continue to reflect on your experience and understand it better, and then you get a thoughtful reply from the person who's writing back to you. And this kind of asynchronous correspondence, I think, increases our understanding of our own experiences and helps us grow and learn about ourselves and other people. So I think that's wonderful. I think that the potential downside to real-time communication when people are separated from home is that if we're immersing them in an experience like summer camp, where a big part of the goal is to help young people learn to make decisions on their own and so forth, then we very much want to have them have some time on their own. And when we bring them together, if we were to bring them together on the phone or by texting, they don't have the opportunity to make some of those decisions. Now, this is interesting because Susan writes in her book about soldiers, for example, in Iraq, and some of them saying, it was wonderful for me to talk to my family on the phone, and others saying, when I spoke with my family on the phone, it made me feel more distressed. Mm-hmm. I got a sense of the distance, and it was hard for me to hear their voices. It's the same thing for young people who are away at boarding school or camp. Some of them look at a photo of their family and are comforted by that and say, these are the people I love. When camp is over or when the semester concludes, I'll get to see them again. Others try that same coping strategy, and it backfires, and they feel worse. Mm-hmm. So my stance is not pro or anti-technology. What I want to do is look at any separation that someone's having and ask, what's the purpose of this separation, and how can we treat their contact with their loved ones in a way that is in accord with the mission here? Mm-hmm. I don't think when we have soldiers abroad that we're trying to nurture their independence. So I see nothing wrong with their getting on the phone if that's something that's going to help them.
Yeah.
But a 12-year-old away at overnight camp, we do want to nurture their independence, so it's good for them to have a couple of weeks where they're not texting.
I guess, though, Chris, the other question I had was, can parents compromise that independence because of technology, or parents who themselves may be, you know, kids sick? It's not even that necessarily the child is feeling homesick or longing to come home, but the parent misses them so much. Can technology then be leveraged to maybe do some damage to that independence or to, you know, compromise a child's development in that way?
Yeah, sure, it can, and you're absolutely right. There are as many anxious parents as there are anxious kids prior to a separation, and some well-intentioned, loving parents will nevertheless undermine their child's experience by surreptitiously packing them a cell phone that they expect them to use when they sneak off into the woods to make a call home, or they'll say something ambiguous, such as, have a wonderful time at camp, I don't know what I'll do without you, or worse yet, they'll make a pickup deal. They'll say, if you feel homesick, I'll come and get you. And that really cuts the camp staff off at their knees. They don't really have a recourse there. The parent can either fulfill their promise and rob their child of what I believe is a very important and powerful developmental experience, or they renege and say, well, I know I said I'd come pick you up, and I'm not going to, in which case you erode the trust you have with your son or daughter. So, yes, anxious parents can misstep, and much of what I've tried to do in the last 15 years is coach parents on the best ways to prepare their son or daughter for some of these wonderful experiences like boarding school or summer camp.
Well, since you mentioned that, and before we go to the phones, let's talk about a couple of those things that parents can do to help.
Well, the most important would be to provide optimistic, positive, and encouraging messages about the separation. So presumably parents are going to be very thoughtful about where they are sending their son or daughter, whether that's a school or camp or other overnight program. And having made a thoughtful selection, I think my top recommendation is that they talk about the separation in very positive terms. My second recommendation would be that they provide their son or daughter with some practice time away from home. So overnight at a friend's house, long weekend at grandparents, so we can begin shorter simulations of what the separation is going to be like. And then the third recommendation would be never to make a pickup deal, because the subtext of, if you feel homesick, I'll come and get you, is, I have so little confidence in your ability to cope with this experience that I think the only solution is for me to come and rescue you.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's the message, you know, kids need to hear when we're preparing them for what should be a very fun and positive growth experience.
Well, we'll talk more about that, but let's do this. Let's go to the phones. We'll start off in Hamilton Square, New Jersey, and we'll welcome Holly to our conversation. Hi, Holly.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm 55, okay, and every once in a while I have the conversation, I just want to go home. And, you know, to that safe space as a child, the place where you don't have to have any stress or whatever. So even though, and I was a very independent child, I mean, I basically couldn't wait to leave, quote-unquote, the nest. But even at the age of 55, I'm like, you know, I just want to go home sometimes. And there's still that longing for that comfort level of, you know, being a child again. So
yeah. Well, thank you, Holly, for sharing that with us. Susan, what do you say about that?
You know, I think that's a remarkably common experience, and one of the tragedies of adulthood is that realization that it's very difficult to go home again, right? This gets back to the idea of nostalgia. Today we talk about nostalgia as a longing for a lost time,
perhaps a lost childhood, when it was originally meaning a longing for a lost place, as in homesickness. And I think that that kind of homesickness that Holly describes is really this modern kind of nostalgia where you're longing to go back to an unrecoverable stage of your life, to a point of security and comfort. And the problem is once you go home, you realize everybody has moved on, you've changed, your house has changed, your parents aren't there. And so the return is much more difficult than we'd hope.
Yeah, we all want to go back to a time when somebody else cooked dinner and paid the bills, right?
Absolutely.
We'll go to Fort Washington next, and we'll welcome Glenn to Radio Times. Hi, Glenn. Glenn, are you with us? Oh, I wonder if... Glenn, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, there we are. All right, your comment or question for our guests.
My comment or question is simply to clarify the difference between using nostalgia as part of homesickness in the Civil War compared to nostalgia as the equivalent of battle fatigue or PTSD, which a lot of people, particularly psychologists and healers and therapists, use the historical basis of nostalgia as part of documenting PTSD. I'll take my comments off air.
Okay, thank you, Glenn. Susan?
Yeah, you know, you see a transformation over the course of the 20th century. Nostalgia is used by Army doctors to describe homesickness up through World War II, and sparingly thereafter. You'll find some references to it up through Vietnam. But gradually, that category of analysis disappears as during World War I, the category of shell shock takes over, and people at the time see a link between being shell-shocked, which is more or less PTSD, and homesickness. That if you're homesick, if you're worried, if you're anxious, they argue that may predispose you to shell-shock. So there's always been kind of an overlap between these different kinds of psychological distress that you feel on the battlefield, where you feel that your old self is slipping away from you, that you're not who you were when you came, that you've seen too much, experienced too much, that you can't mentally return to who you were, and somewhere that you'll never be able to physically return to where you were.
Well, let's go to Trenton next, and we'll welcome Michael to Radio Times. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi. I have a question, and I guess it's a partial comment as well, and I can also take my answer off the air. I moved to California last summer, and I wanted to strike it out on my own. As the previous caller, Holly, stated, I'm a very independent person myself. At 17, I moved out. I went to college. I paid for it myself. And then I wanted to, I guess, see some new scenery, strike it on my own. So I went to California, and it was in the third month that I was there that I realized that I just can't fit in. Everyone is very laid back, and the attitude is completely different. I'm almost conditioned to more rude people and rude behavior. And as complicated as that sounds, I couldn't adjust. I'm not a rude person myself, but when you're dealing with it day in, day out, it tends to be your reality, your world is just people are like this. And I couldn't adjust. So I had to come back. It's almost my homesickness was I just yearned for what was familiar, the rudeness and the hustle and just people being the way they are in New Jersey.
Just not enough stress for you, right?
Yeah, not enough.
Chris, what do you say to that?
Well, this is interesting. I think it's wonderful. I had a parallel experience since I grew up in Maine and then went to college in Boston, went to graduate school at UCLA, so I was able to experience California for 4 years and then Seattle for three, and now I'm back in New England in New Hampshire. And I would say that we habituate to these experiences, whether others would deem them to be obnoxious or rude or something. It's familiar to us, and the same can be said of customs and food and the environment, such as it is, urban or rural. And I think that there's something, again, very adaptive about our feeling out of place in an unfamiliar location with customs or traditions that are a bit strange to us. And some people, I think this is temperamental, adapt well to that, and they see it as an adventure, and they mold themselves to the new culture in a very comfortable way. And other people like this caller, and I would categorize myself in the same group. We'd rather be, in a familiar location with customs and foods and traditions that are familiar to us that we grew up with. You know, Susan said earlier, and it's true, it's disappointing to go home and realize how much has changed. But I think we all have an opportunity as adults to begin now creating, whether we work with young people or whether we have children of our own, to begin creating experiences for them that are the nurturing, comforting home experiences. So if you can't go back to it, at least you can begin to create a new one.
Well, and that brings up an interesting point and something that Susan has written and talked about. I'm thinking, Susan, about the enslaved Africans who were here and what you said about them not necessarily being homesick for Africa in the sense that when they were asked where's home, the response would be Mississippi or someplace like that.
Yeah, you know, it's a tragic chapter in America's history, and the emotional import of slavery shouldn't be underestimated. What I found when I was doing research was that throughout the history of slavery in America, slaves were moved so often against their will, and sometimes the first generation longed for Africa, but a lot of times people put down roots in a new place and became very connected to Mississippi or Georgia or Virginia, and when their masters sold them, they'd try to run back to those spots and became very identified with the local southern culture of which they had partaken.
And then we see in later years the immigrants who came in and did exactly what you said, where they sort of recreated those communities that reminded them of home.
Yeah, I was very much struck by Michael's comment when he said he didn't know he was a New Jerseyan really until he came to California, because so many immigrants had that experience, saying they didn't realize they were Polish or Slavic until they came to America and realized that they had these customs and traditions and a sense of self that differed from the people around them. And one way they coped with that feeling of being in an unfamiliar place was to try to make the world as familiar as possible. So little Italian neighborhoods, little Chinese neighborhoods were all about having all the comforts of home, from the food your mother cooked you to the social clubs you had enjoyed. And so many of those ethnic neighborhoods were constituted around village ties that had existed in the old world and were transplanted almost completely to the U.S.
Yeah, and so many of them still exist and, in fact, make up our nation today. Really interesting.
Yeah, and I think so much of our culture is based on these memories of other places. It's very American to be homesick, and our culture has all these traces of the emotion throughout it.
Well, we are talking about homesickness and why we get homesick and what we can do to help ourselves when we're in that situation or someone we love is homesick. Lots more to talk about on Radio Times when we come right back.
Philadelphia Folk Festival proudly supports WHYY. This year's Folk Festival features Little Feat, John Hyatt and the Combo, Steve Earle and the Dukes, Trombone Shorty and Orleans Avenue, Lucinda Williams, Mike Cross, Mary Chapin Carpenter, and more at the Old Pool Farm near Schwanksville in Upper Salford Township, August 17th through the 19th. For a weekend of concerts, crafts, camping, and children's activities, the Philadelphia Folk Festival, 800-556-FOLK or folkfest.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Bishop Leonard Blair. He helped conduct the doctrinal assessment of the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, an organization representing 80% of U.S. nuns. Now he's assigned to help make sure the group conforms to the Church's teachings on human sexuality, the right to life, the ordination of women, and other issues. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. The British government has accepted the claims of Kenyans who said they were tortured at the end of colonial rule. So what happens now? Also, veteran Olympics reporter John Powers looks back at his most memorable Olympics. It's not that far back. Beijing, 2008. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about homesickness and how people have experienced it historically, how people experience it even now, and what we can do to help ourselves along with that. We have been talking with the author of a book called Homesickness and American History. Her name is Dr. Susan Matt. We're also talking with Dr. Chris Thurber, who is a psychologist, an educator, an author, a dad. He's also an expert when it comes to homesickness. So picking up where we left off, so interesting the things that you were saying there, Susan, on the back end of our conversation about, you know, immigrants, about different people who have come to this country and how they have addressed the issue of homesickness. I want to bring in one of our callers because I think it ties into what we've been talking about. We'll go to Norristown and welcome Louise to Radio Times. Hi, Louise.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
The reason I'm calling is my daughter is 37 and she has singly raised my wonderful granddaughter. And my granddaughter is leaving for France in a few weeks, and I was looking for any advice to give my granddaughter, who's going to be in France, and my daughter, who will be by herself for the first time.
Well, what do you say, folks? Let's start with Chris. What advice would you have for a daughter and granddaughter in this case?
Well, I think for both of them, it's going to be important prior to the daughter's departure to have a plan of how are we going to keep in touch, because obviously they love each other. They're going to miss each other. That's normal. I think that the experience in France is going to bring with it a lot of challenges as well as a lot of wonderful new experiences. And if they're able to stay in touch in a way that makes them both feel good, even if they're missing each other, that's excellent. But having a plan ahead of time is really good. I've found that when students travel abroad, again, if there has been a provisional plan that if you don't like it or if it's kind of hard or if you feel homesick, you can shorten the stay, that becomes a mental crutch. And so while I don't want anyone to suffer, and I don't think it's ethical to stay apart if you're truly miserable, I do think that the daughter and the mom can expect that there'll be some challenging times, but if they're both committed to the duration of the experience, whatever that duration is, then I think it's easier to do what Susan was talking about prior to the break. When we go to a new place, we install ourselves a bit and we bring parts of home, whether that's photos on our phone or maybe a physical photograph, even though that seems a little old-fashioned, some trappings of home, including our own clothes and some of our own customs. She's obviously going to have no trouble bringing her own language with her, although I hope she learns a lot of French. She's going to do some things, the daughter is, to make herself feel at home in her host country. I think the more that the mom gets involved in learning about her daughter's experience, write to me or email me and tell me every once in a while what's new and what your days have been like, and I'm so excited to hear. And from my end, the mom should say, you know, I will update you with some newsy and upbeat sorts of things of what's going on locally. And I think that that's going to make it a wonderful experience. So a plan to stay in touch and a positive attitude are going to go a long way toward making that stay fantastic.
And Chris, that's such good advice and really something that can be applied in so many places, because now, you know, young people are not just leaving for college. So many of them, as part of that college experience, are spending a semester or even a whole year abroad now.
Right.
So it's important advice, I think, that can be used in lots of ways. We were talking about France, and that leads to this question, Susan. Is there a difference in the way that people in other cultures experience homesickness, different from perhaps the way we experience it here in the United States?
Well, given how many cultures there are, I don't want to generalize about the other parts of the world. However, I think we're a pretty silent culture on it. And it's not just a difference in culture, but a difference in time. So, for instance, in the 19th century and early 20th century,
if you were homesick and you were an Italian immigrant in America, there's a very good chance you would go home. It's estimated that close to 50% of Italian immigrants in America went home. This is common for all immigrant groups, I should mention, but there certainly was less shame among them. So 46% of Greeks go back, 30% of Poles go back, there seemed to be more acceptance of that. So to me, the bigger difference is not so much between cultures, but between times.
And it's interesting to look at how, you know, some of those different cultures do that, and it also raises the question, was there a turning point here in the United States? Was there a point, Susan, at which it became not cool to admit that you were homesick or to display any outward signs of that? I mean, at what point did that change?
I think the answer is the early 20th century, and there were a couple different influences. One was the vestiges of social Darwinism, which seemed to argue that if you couldn't adapt to particular environments, there was something wrong with you. And a lot of social psychologists, starting in the late 19th century, began to say, the more savage races are more tied to home, they're inferior, they can't move on, they're not modern, they don't make progress, they're stuck where they are. So there was this kind of evolutionary discussion that got linked to homesickness. And then within psychology in the early 20th century, there were a number of thinkers like John Watson, the behaviorist psychologist, who argued that parents shape the characters of their children and should only expose them to particular influences. He suggested that parents should never hug their children or kiss their children, should only shake hands with them in the morning so that their children wouldn't get too tied to them emotionally and would be able to move on. And that got echoed by later generations of psychologists in the 40s and 50s. One professor of medicine, actually from University of Pennsylvania, declared that mothers were America's gravest menace, because they were psychologically in wombing their children and keeping them tied to home too much. So it became a kind of a new fashion in psychology to worry about the connection to home, and in particular the connection to mother. Moms got slammed during the mid-century as being overprotective.
It's fascinating. We'll go back to the phones to Freehold, New Jersey, and Carol. Welcome, Carol, to Radio Times.
Hi there. I'm 20 years old, and I'm starting my junior year of college. I actually just recently transferred from a school in Maryland, a state school, to Rutgers University. And when I was doing that, I was at my other school for probably about three semesters, and I was so against transferring, I feel like, because I think that there's such a stigma with people, at least my age, and seeing it around my friends, going home, going back to somewhere that you actually enjoy. And I felt like people were judging me, seeing that I was weak and just was not, not smart enough. And finally, I got out of that mindset and bit the ball and came home, and I'm loving it ever since. But I just want to know why it's seen as, not smart to leave.
Well, let me put that question to our guests. Chris, what would you have to say about that? I mean, there is certainly that sort of 13th grade kind of sense in many communities that unless you leave home, something's not quite right.
Yeah, I mean, I disagree with that, and I think Susan and I are probably on the same page here. I applaud the caller for transferring. I did myself when I was unhappy with the school where I started as an undergraduate, and I think, if you're unhappy with the place where you are, as long as you've given it a decent try, then I think you need to vote with your feet. I don't think that we should be obsessed with experiences that nurture our independence. I think there's room for some, and I'm a huge fan of summer camp as a vehicle for doing that. But I think that we need to ask two questions. One is, are we unhappy because we're mostly missing things about home, but we like this environment in which we're immersed? Or do we dislike the environment in which we're immersed? And, of course, we miss home, but mostly we're feeling bad because we don't like where we are. Those are really two different things. And if the answer is, I really don't like where I am, I don't like the fact that I've endured this prolonged hospitalization, or I don't like the fact that I have been exiled from my home country, or I don't like the fact that I'm enlisted and fighting overseas, and it's no fun to go out on the battlefield, that's an understatement, or it's no fun to be forced into exile. Now we're talking not just about missing things from home, but experiencing a really noxious, novel environment. And there, I think, I don't know what your first school was like, but I'm glad that you transferred. And I think if you are more comfortable being based at home, I think that's wonderful. Everybody's different, and there's a time and a place to, you know, spread our wings and move, but it's certainly not a requirement. And I think Susan said at the beginning of the show, we tend to be in our society very focused on mobility, and that's not necessary. But the way that businesses run, we're expected to uproot ourselves and transfer if we get that promotion. And I don't think that that's the healthiest thing always for families or individuals.
And, you know, Chris, in an indirect way, maybe the economy is helping to erase that stigma as more and more students are contemplating staying close to home, if for no other reason than to save a lot of money.
Yeah.
So we'll go back to the phones in East Falls. Welcome, Harlan, to Radio Times.
Hi, thank you. I'm just curious about people who don't seem to miss home or are able to travel and don't have these feelings. I travel a lot. And when I was younger, I traveled then, and the need to call home was not real strong. Do you experience this much in others?
Interesting question. Thanks, Harlan. Chris, what do you think?
Yeah, I think so. Roland's pretty normal. I think that it varies by temperament. In other words, I think that for some people, their temperaments allow them to experience novelty and to really enjoy it. Other people are made more anxious by new experiences, and they're more physiologically reactive. So when they're in a new place, you know, their heart rate is higher, their adrenaline and stress hormones like cortisol are more prevalent in their bloodstream. And you may be one of those folks whose response to novelty is very positive and very easygoing, and that's wonderful. And a good portion of the population is in that category.
All right, well, thanks for that call, and we'll go to Hatboro next and welcome Pat to Radio Times. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I'm calling because we were, as part of an organization, we were in a one-year language and cultural orientation. One of the things we, one of the things we learned early on that there's a six-week when you're in a new culture, especially for a period of time, there's a six-week time in which at some point you're going to hit the wall. And it's usually right about 6 weeks after you've gotten there, even if you're really thriving and doing well, just something happens. And for a while, the depression, the homesickness and stuff comes in a wave. And so I just wanted to mention that six-week time and then also just say, the change in culture is a hugely overpowering thing for many people, and preparation is key. So I suggest that girl going to France, prepare well for the cultural transition, because France is very different from the States. That's it.
Well, and that brings up an interesting point. Susan, I'm wondering if you, or Chris for that matter, have you come across that in your research, that sort of six-week mark?
I found that there was a lot of variability. So some people felt the emotion, got over it pretty quickly. Some people seem to feel it and never get past the wall. And they might live in the United States for 30 years, or they might have just moved within the United States, but they still felt it as acutely, or almost as acutely as at the very beginning of their travels. So I didn't see necessarily that clear a six-week pattern. I'm sure Chris is more familiar with the psychological studies that may have aggregated statistics on that.
Yeah, and those studies also show a lot of variability in the timeline. So there doesn't tend to be a predictable timeline unless you're talking about very discrete experiences such as a 2 or 4 week stay away from home at summer camp. And in those cases, the most homesick kids tend to get worse over time until just prior to closing day, when they can sort of see the light at the end of the tunnel. So I think the timeline may be different for different people or different groups of people having similar experiences.
Yeah.
So, you know, Pat's observation is interesting. I want to also point out that...
And Chris, I'm going to ask you to do this quickly because
yeah.
we have a little treat for our listeners at the end of the show, and we want to make sure we have time for it. But go ahead.
Oh, great. Well, just very quickly, I think a person can be homesick and also happy. My good friend Michael Thompson, who's also a psychologist, has written a book called Homesickness and Homesick and Happy, and he makes the point in that book that yes, it's a negative emotion, and you can endure it, and at the same time, you can enjoy yourself and get through an experience. So I just, it's not an either or.
Well, I want to take this quick moment. I want to thank you, Dr. Chris Thurber, for being with us, Dr. Susan Matt, for helping us understand these issues around homesickness. And we want to leave you today with a little tune, Brooke Benton's Don't It Make You Wanna Go Home. Here it is, a little something to send us on our way with.
Or the whippoorwill roost on the telephone pole, and the Georgia sun goes down. Well, it's been a long time, but I'm glad that I'm going back to my hometown. Going down to the Greyhound station, gonna buy me a one-way fare. And if the good Lord's willing and the preach don't rise by tomorrow, I'm gonna be there.
Don't it make you wanna go home? Don't it make you wanna go home?
All God's children get weary when they're roam. Don't it make you wanna go home? There's a six-lane highway down by the creek where I went skinny dipping as a child, and a drive-in show where the meadows used to grow and the strawberries used to grow wild. There's a drag strip down by the riverside where my grandma's cow used to graze. Now the grass don't grow and the river don't flow like it did in my childhood days.
Don't it make you wanna go home?